In the south of France, scientists from around the world are constructing the most complex machine ever built. It's called the International Thermonuclear Experimental Reactor, the latest in a long line of expensive, frustrating, impossibly complicated, and promising attempts to create fusion energy on Earth. Rafi Khachaturian, a staff writer for The New Yorker, wrote an article called A Star in a Bottle for the March 3rd issue of the magazine about ITER, the ITER project, both its potential and perils. And I'm very pleased to welcome Mr. Khachaturian to our show today. Hello.
Hi, it's nice to be here.
Now, what exactly is nuclear fusion? It's not to be confused with nuclear fission.
That's right. Nuclear fusion is a process by which sunlight is generated and heat from the sun, the things that we experience every day coming from our closest star. What happens is that two atoms or two atomic nuclei are forced into very close proximity. They're essentially slammed together, and they join to form a new atomic nuclei, a single one. And in the process by which they're combined, they release a ton of energy. And that is the energy that people who are working in nuclear fusion are attempting to harness in its simplest form.
Whereas with nuclear fission, you are breaking the atom apart and releasing energy. But this is,
exactly.
Seems to be a lot harder to do.
It is. It's tremendously difficult. The first experimental fission reactor, I think, was created in the 1940s. I want to say 1942. And still today, we don't have a working fusion reactor.
We've had a number of people claim that they had come up with something and they've all not worked. How is this ITER reactor supposed to work, at least in theory?
Well, there has been progress, and the whole ITER design is based upon decades worth of progress. And to say that fusion doesn't work is not 100% right. I'll just backtrack a little bit. It does work. It is possible to create fusion reactions on Earth. It just hasn't been possible to create them in a way that manufactures a net gain in energy. And the ITER design is hopefully what will take the scientific community beyond that threshold. And the way it works is you have this very large chamber that's the shape of a donut, and you puff into that chamber some isotopes of hydrogen. These are atoms of hydrogen that have additional neutrons in them. And you get just the right mixture of that in there, and you heat it up to tremendous temperatures. And in the act of heating it, you hope these atoms slam together and form self-sustaining fusion reactions, essentially putting a star into a little bottle, or in that case, actually, a very big bottle.
They're creating helium? Or something
and,
like,
yes, the net,
and what about
yes,
radiation? And, is that a byproduct of this?
Well, so what happens is that yes, there is radiation that's created, but in the fission reaction, what happens is that atoms decay and they form other forms of radioactive atoms. And in the case of fusion, as you said, the byproduct is helium, which is a stable and inert element. And so that particular byproduct is okay. And so generally that's the great appeal of fusion is that you're not creating nuclear waste. In essence, I should say, there is some waste in the fact that the machine itself does become activated and eventually, but not for a terribly long period of time.
Well, we've talked in the past about how there is less helium available now than there was in the past. So maybe we'll be able to blow up those balloons again. How much more energy would this reactor need to create than is put into it? In other words, you mentioned earlier, you have to make this thing commercially viable.
Yeah, and so, I mean, a star, for instance, is totally self-sustaining. And so basically, you know, all the energy is kind of produced right there on the spot. But in the case of something that we would be operating on Earth, you would want to have it be around 30 or 40 times the amount of energy being produced internally within this cloud that is being maintained inside the device. And you would want to be putting some energy into it so that you could control and manipulate it and would be able to have some effect on it.
Well, the ITER plant will burn at a temperature that's more than 10 times as hot as the core of the sun?
That's right. That's
and then
right.
contained by a magnetic field 260,000 times greater than Earth's?
Yeah.
Why does a fusion plant need to be so hot and so magnetized?
Well, here's the thing. The sun, the way this process works is all about forcing atoms together. And the sun does that by a combination of very high temperature, but also incredible gravity. The sun's gravity is enormous. And that gravity helps in forcing these atoms together. And we here on Earth cannot recreate that gravitational force. It's just beyond our ability to do that. So the scientific community's strategy is to compensate by extreme temperature. And so that's the reason why they need to go 10 times hotter than the sun. And the state of matter inside this magnetic bottle, as you indicated, is called plasma, and it exerts its own complicated forces, and so it needs to be contained. And when you have something that's 150 million degrees, it's basically going to you can't put it in any kind of physical object, and so you have to contain it magnetically.
And isn't it difficult to get the magnetic fields right? One scientist compared it to holding jelly in rubber bands.
It is. It's an immense challenge, and there have been various techniques to do this. In the case of ITER, it's shaped like a donut, and anything that has that kind of circular shape is going to have some kind of magnetic imbalance in it, and because the geometry of the inside of the donut is smaller than the geometry of the outside, and so they've come up with all kinds of solutions. But basically, if you close your eyes and you imagine what you've seen as the surface of the sun, you see this kind of roiling sea of magnetic instability, and that's what they're contending with, and that's part of been the great challenge in creating a working fusion reactor, is how do you contain this plasma, this incredibly difficult substance to handle.
Keep it from flying apart.
Well, exactly. That's what it wants to do. It wants to spread out.
But we've been talking about all the heat. The magnets need to be cooled to 269 degrees below zero, which is nearly the temperature of deep space. So we are trying to create heat that is hotter than the sun and then cold that is nearly the temperature of deep space all on Earth. And people are going to have to work around it.
They're feet apart from each other. They're feet apart. Their feet. The magnets are just feet away, a few feet away from the interior of that plasma core, which is so hot.
Wow. And people will have to be working, I guess, as far away from this as possible. I can't imagine being near that kind of cold or heat. My guest is Rafi Khachaturian, who is a staff writer with The New Yorker, and his article, A Star in a Bottle, is in the March 3rd issue of the magazine. It's about the project we're talking about, the ITER project. The reactor is a tokamak, which was developed by the Soviet Union in the early 1960s. What were they hoping to do with that?
It was in the 1950s, I actually believe.
Well, I think it went online in 60 to 65 or so. That's what.
Yes. So basically, they were the design. Andrei Sakharov actually was an important figure in developing that design, and
the father of the Soviet hydrogen bomb.
Yeah, he basically took a break between his bomb work to develop this, and the logic and the appeal. The logic at that time is very similar to what it is today, which is that the appeal of fusion energy is huge because you're basically using hydrogen as a fuel, and it's one of the most abundant elements in the universe, if not the most abundant. And fusion is, and you would be creating huge amounts of energy with minimal waste and a highly abundant fuel. And so they saw the implications of that way back when, as did American scientists also during the Cold War. And the tokamak is the Soviet design, which is it also happens to be the design that the community is working off of today in ITER.
Are they better than the reactors that were designed in the United States or in the West in general?
You know, the community has gotten behind the tokamak because it has performed better, but also a lot of money has gone into the tokamak, and there are some people who would argue that other designs should be pursued. But currently, it's the best performing design in terms of confinement, which is the amount of time that you can sort of keep the plasma together, and a number of other metrics.
Well, how have they been used in the past, these tokamaks? You've called the project a fragment of the Cold War stranded in the present day. Were they seen as weapons, part of a weapons program, or were they seen as an energy program?
Always energy, but I'll tell you a great story. It's actually not in the piece. Very early on, when they wanted to collaborate, the U.S. and the Soviet Union wanted to collaborate. There were people on either side of the Cold War who said, "Look, let's get together and build this thing called called ITER on this big project." There was discussions in the White House, in the White House Situation Room, and between members of the State Department and Department of Energy and members of the Defense Department about whether there could be any military application to this technology. And members of the State Department and DOE just spent a lot of energy trying to convince the guys on the military side that no, it's okay. This thing has no military application, and that kind of convincing was key to getting, the support of the military, I guess, to make this overture or to participate in this joint project with the Soviets, which is how ITER began.
Well, how many countries are collaborating on ITER now?
It's 34 countries now, so it's actually the largest scientific collaboration in the world.
And I get a sense from your article that the entire project is an enormous bureaucratic maze. You use the phrase "scientific tower of Babel."
Yeah, that's right. It's a very complicated arrangement, and I think your listeners might go running to the hills if I get too detailed and too immersed in it. But to get all the countries participating, the system that was ultimately designed is that each country would produce what are called in-kind contributions, which means that they give some cash to the sort of central ITER bureaucracy, but most of what they're doing is they're producing parts, and in some cases they're even producing parts of parts, segments of parts. And so you have all of these, this thing has basically hundreds of thousands of parts that are being created all around the world and by all these different countries, and they all have to be sent to the south of France and assembled in what was will probably be the largest puzzle in the world, and hopefully it will all fit together.
Well, the engineers have to ensure that everything is built to exact specifications. And I wondered, why do it that way? Wouldn't it make more sense to fabricate the whole thing on site?
It would. Part of it is about sharing the cost. Part of it is about the spirit of collaboration. But there is a kind of more pragmatic, let's say, thing working here. A lot of the technology that's going into ITER, some of it is state-of-the-art. For instance, you mentioned helium, and helium is used to cool magnets, and a lot of the magnet technology in ITER will be state-of-the-art. And so many of the countries involved say, hey, if we're going to participate in this, we want to have a hand in learning how to make the state-of-the-art technology. And so that's why complex components are divided in these kind of unusual ways so that everyone can have a piece of them. Which is great, I guess, in if you want to have some kind of near-term gain and want to know how to build a complex magnet. But it does set up obstacles to building the whole, because it means now that parts are being divided in weird ways for their manufacture and design.
Didn't you visit it in the south of France? Where in the south of France?
It's about half an hour's north drive of Aix-en-Provence, and it's beautiful country. And when I went there, there was just this huge, this huge pit where the main reactor core is going to be situated, and it's supported by hundreds of what are called like sort of seismic isolation plinths that will allow the device to sort of remain unharmed by any kind of earthquake event.
And when is it projected to be completed?
Oh, that is a really difficult question to answer, because the project has been suffering from great scheduling problems, and they're not getting things done in the way that they had hoped to. So their hope has been to turn on the machine in, early 2020s. And that would just be turning it on and running some tests and not really doing real science on it. But it looks like that's sliding and sliding, and this schedule loss has kind of really put the project into a state of crisis.
On the other hand, we were speaking earlier about the collapse of the West Antarctic ice sheet. How much of the ITER project is motivated by concerns over climate change?
I would definitely say that a large number of the participants, if not all of them, see what they're doing as a potential solution to climate change, because nuclear fusion, if it works, would not be a form of energy production that would cause carbon, release carbon into the atmosphere, which, of course, has been a key driver of climate change.
And we wouldn't have all that nuclear waste as we have in the current nuclear power plants.
You wouldn't. The nuclear waste, it's kind of an interesting phenomenon. When the way in which the ITER functions is by creating heat, and then you create steam, and then you use steam to power turbines. And the way that heat would be created in something like ITER, a tokamak-style reactor, is by many neutrons that are propelled out of this cloud of thermonuclear gas. And those neutrons, they are not contained by the magnets. And so, yes, they're slamming into things that create heat, but they're also slamming into the machine itself, and they're causing just components in the machine to become radioactive. And those components would be radioactive for about 100 years, which, of course, is much different from the nuclear waste that needs to be stored away for 10,000 years or much greater. And so people who work in fusion and who think about this problem do hope to create metals that would be resistant to this kind of activation, but they also feel that radiation that can be contained within a single human lifespan, essentially, is a manageable amount of radiation.
A number of scientific teams announced in the past that they had developed workable nuclear fusion. I remember the coal fusion thing, only to have their claims debunked. Do you think that this project actually is feasible? Or are we going to have another embarrassment somewhere down the line?
I think that if the project now suffers from a lot of bureaucratic problems, and it suffers from a lot of, and these bureaucratic problems are having an effect on the engineering. And those things are real things to consider. But if you're asking me whether I think the physics of what is being envisioned is, whether it's possible that, based on all we know about the tokamaks that have been previously designed and the progress that has made, would a machine like this, if it's designed in the way that it's supposed to be designed, cross the threshold, the important threshold of producing fusion reactions that create energy? Is that possible? And is it not only possible, but is it realistic? I think it is. But I think it's going to be really up to the team to solve some of their administrative issues and build the machine as it should be. Beyond that, though, is whether or not something like this would ever be economically feasible to build, and what are the successor machines to this, since this is only an experimental device. And so there are many unknowns ahead. But it could well be, if it is pursued as it is, as the scientific community hopes, there's reasonable physics behind what is being attempted, and so it's not necessarily it doesn't have to let people down the way it has in the past.
Well, if this succeeds, it'll be great for France. They won't have to worry about electricity for a while, but then you have to build more of these. And you write, 6,000 miles of cable will run through the machine, delivering electrical power to 250,000 terminal points. One heating system will send 1 million watts of microwave radiation through a window made of a large synthetic diamond. That sounds really complicated.
Yeah, and one of the critiques that some people have about the tokamak design is that ITER is an experimental device. It's never going to put power into the grid. But people have said, look, even if you develop this, even if you get this to work, even if you manage to create a star, you're designing a machine that's so complex that it will never be something that a utility will actually want to run and operate. And so it won't make economic sense, even if you are able to accomplish the physics of it.
How much has it cost so far?
Well, the current price tag is $20 billion for this device. And it's probably going to go up. That's probably conservative. So, and the other side of the argument is that technology is this way, and that the early experimental versions of a device are always more expensive and cumbersome. And you know, one thing to be remembered is that the United States spent $100 billion on the Apollo program, about $8 billion per year in today's dollars, and that's not even a fraction of what is being invested in this kind of research.
Rafi,
that's
a lot more money than
I went the wrong way.
And if this works, well, this could be pretty terrific, but who knows? We'll know in 2020 or sometime after that. Rafi Khachaturian is a staff writer for The New Yorker. His article, A Star in a Bottle, is in the March 3rd issue of The New Yorker. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.